for February 20th, 2007 will come to order. We have three matters on the agenda for today, and I'm trying to do a little triage to make sure we get them all in an appropriate way. Depending upon the number of people we have signed up, and we're about to find out, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2228. Mr. Phillips, go ahead and give us a review while he comes up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2228 will increase the authority of the county assessors to extend time for filing tax returns until April 15th if there's sufficient cause or if doing so will enhance the accuracy of filing the taxpayer compliance. Currently, under current law, the assessors don't have the authority to do so, just to enhance the accuracy of the filing. And the Department of Revenue does not have the authority except under rulemaking, and this bill will also grant them the authority to do both, to extend it for just cause and to also do it in the event that they feel that it will increase the accuracy and taxpayer compliance.
Great. Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue, and House Bill 2228 does exactly what Mary's summarized, and it essentially allows the assessors who, and we're talking about property tax returns for property that's reported to the assessor for businesses like personal property and real property, and they have to file a return annually, and there's a deadline. They have to meet that deadline. Sometimes an extension is warranted, but currently the assessors only have the ability to grant an extension for what's called good cause. The department has a little broader authority. We can grant it for good cause or for other reasons like administrative needs of the business, if their year-end books aren't closed yet. This would simply extend the ability the department already has to what counties have on their accounts. The second idea in this bill is that in some cases there are a business has property in many, many counties, and the extensions are granted by some and denied by others, possibly, and this would grant the department authority to grant an extension to a company who would file in multiple counties. It makes it a little easier for the taxpayer. And that's the focus of this bill.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Phillips? I have just one. There's a lot of language in this bill. All of the language is related to the issues you've raised.
Mr. Chair, yes, other than I think legislative council inserted some words like county in front of assessor and...
Yes.
But a lot of what you see that starts on the bottom of the second page, line 37, is cut and pasted also into page 3, starting on line 5. You'll see a lot of basically duplicate language for what the county assessor can do then and what the department can do. Some of this language is that we asked for, that spells out a little bit more in detail what our administrative rule tries to focus on. And on the back page of your handout, my testimony, I've taken an excerpt from one of our administrative rules. We have granted extensions for what we call administrative need, and that is we try to define that in our rule, and then we'll kind of summarize that in the bill by saying granting extensions, and I'm on, let's say, page 3, line 24. That would enhance the accuracy of the filing of the taxpayer, long-term voluntary compliance, just kind of describing sort of the conditions under which an extension might be granted.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Phillips? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, do counties or do real property owners, business real property owners, file a return on real property, or is it strictly on personal property, and when would they be filing on real property, filing an additional return?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if a business like a large home building supply store reported a return on a return, they might file on real and personal. Personal would be the cash registers and the shelving or anything that's not bolted down. Anything that's bolted down, the building, the large structural things that are bolted down, or lines of processing that are bolted down, are defined as real property. So the difference is the movable versus non-movable, and so they have both typically.
That's the question I asked on another bill.
Exactly.
I had to drag out of my head from a first year of law school that a machine that's bolted to the floor is real property, not personal property.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And the 7-Up bottling case from decades ago was the landmark case that made the distinction between what was real and what was personal.
Well, actually, it comes from the bewigged guys in the common law in England almost 1,000 years ago.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Berger.
This extension is till April 15th. I thought all these property assessments had a November due date. Or did they all explain to me that April?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the April date is the date on which they notify the appraisal entity, which is either the department or the county, of the value of their property. That's when the appraisers then take that information and start validating, verifying, applying depreciation tables, visit site visits. Yeah. And then that is on the following November 15th tax statement. You're absolutely correct.
It's actually March 1st is that when these returns are due,
unless they get
the extension.
The extension will make it. Okay, so March 1st is their date.
Correct.
Got it. I'm getting it.
And just to confuse you, that's for the January 1st assessment date. So
right, yeah.
It's the value.
As of January 1.
January 1.
Right. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, is there anything that you mentioned that by extending this until April 15th, that would give then the assessors an opportunity to go out and actually physically examine property and those kinds of things? Is there anything sacred about that April 15th date? Could it be April 30th? Could it be June 1st? I recognize that pretty soon you're pushing the envelope on the time that it needs to be examined and put onto the tax rolls. But I'm concerned because of some other issues with the department right now that folks are saying, well, we've got to file a return in February that isn't really due until June 30th, but they have us file it early and then not pay anything on it. And there's these dates that seem to come up, but really have no firm date with regard to the why it couldn't be June 1st or something of that nature. Can you help us with the April or the March 1st versus the April 15th and why it's not April 30th?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it's just simply a matter of the workload involved with processing hundreds of thousands of returns. I'm not sure the exact number, but each county has a number of returns they deal with. The department has a number of returns we deal with. And it's getting all that information, and what they're reporting are typically costs, for example. And so then that cost has to be retrodated to January 1, and then the depreciation has to be applied, and the different types of machinery and equipment that they're reporting has to be parsed. They have an analysis has to be done of what's been retired from the last return, what's been added from the last return. So it's basically an appraiser's responsibility to value the property, and one document they have is the return. There may be a lot of other information, so it could be April 30th, but that squeezes the workload time and the number of accounts they have. It could be February 1, and that would squeeze the taxpayers' time to report the information. And so it's
okay.
It's been what the filing return time has been for quite a while, but I don't know how long it seems to be workable for most, from what I've heard.
Just a follow-up on that,
yes,
Mr. Chair. If we had, for instance, June 1st is the date, and June 30th is the drop-dead date with regard to this property, and they accepted the return as filed and then subsequently found out on audit that there was a change, that the change can affect the retroactive year as well. Is that not correct? Plus interest on it.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm not sure I followed the question.
In other words, is it
germane to this bill?
It is indeed, because
okay.
My concern, Mr. Chair, is that to the extent these dates, and I don't want to push the assessors any closer to a drop dead date than what they've got.
Yeah.
My concern is that if April 15th isn't enough time for them to actually examine and physically document what was tied down, what was bolted down, etc., and they find that there was an actual under-reporting in the return, they can actually then retroactively go back and assess the tax on that
incorrectly filed return.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, they can make it work both directions. If there was something that was not reported,
under or over,
it can be corrected.
Sure.
If there's something that was overreported, that can be corrected. And there's a separate statute that lays out the details on that.
We've already talked about that.
Well, that's my concern, Mr. Chair, is that the and I appreciate it. I don't want to push our assessors any further than where they have to go.
In aid of that concern, let me ask a question. And this bill is acceptable to the assessors, the county assessors?
Mr. Chair and committee, we meet with the assessors on specifically these issues. We have a special group that representatives appear.
And they're willing
they're
willing to move this date 6 weeks to the 15th of April.
They requested it.
In these situations that you specified in the bill. So I think that answers the question.
It does indeed.
You're dealing with Representative Butler. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Phillips? Thank you, sir. Is there further testimony on House Bill 2228? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2228. Let's see. I'm trying to make sure that we get things done expeditiously. I think Representative Olson has a conflict that keeps him away for the meeting today, so there's no reason for us not to go ahead with the work session on House Bill 2239. So let's open the work session on House Bill 2239. Mary, would you give us the summary on that and also talk about the amendment?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The original bill modifies procedures for reviewing assessment rules and corrects clerical errors, omissions, and adds omitted property to the tax rolls that are prepared by the Department of Revenue for assessment and apportionment of centrally assessed property. It sets June 15th as a specific date when the department shall review the tentative rule for omissions and clerical errors, and it applies to assessment rules initially proposed or corrected after the effective date of this act. Previously, a representative from the Department of Revenue summarized the bill and requested certain amendments because there were two areas that were discussed here that were not added. One, we needed the department recommended adding language that would clarify that the taxpayer would have 90 days in which to an appeal to the tax court if aggrieved of an assessment, and this is what one aspect of the amendment does. And the other one was to add a little insertion there that in one of the sections that clarifies that only after the tax roll has been certified is a time at which point the department may correct clerical errors or omissions, and it is not prohibiting the department from correcting an error in the opinion of its value. And that little insertion of for the purposes of this subsection was discussed at the last meeting, and it needed to be in the text, or the department would not have the ability any longer to change its value.
I see. Thank you. And that's actually a rewrite then of the sub 4 on page 4, lines 17 through 19, as I see it. And the way I perceive it, it simply is a rewrite of that section so that the language works better.
Right.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I move that we append the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2239, the amendment dated 2-12-07.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2239. Is there a discussion?
Did I get the amendments?
Where? You'll note that the 90-day issue is dealt with by adding the statute 305.280, which you'll also find in Section 11 for easy reference on page 5, where we've added the 90 days as part of the language of the bill. So that's the 90-day issue. And then the other language is simply a rewrite of the error in valuation issue.
It simply adds for the purposes of
right
in on page 4
for the purposes of this section. Yes, thank you. Anything else? Is there any objection to the Dash 1 amendments? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are adopted. Representative Reed?
Sure. I move that we send House Bill 2239 to the floor with the due process recommendation.
Representative Reed moves House Bill 2239 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative
Green.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Witt. Aye. Chair votes aye. Who did we not call? Oh, well, two members are excused. Thank you. This bill has received a unanimous vote of the committee. Is there a reason why it should not be assigned to the consent calendar?
Mr. Chair, we've had no negative comment.
None at
on
all.
This bill. I don't know of any reason why we couldn't move
it. Is there objection to assigning this to the consent calendar? Then we'll assign it to the consent calendar. Thank you. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2239 after it has the motion having received a majority vote to pass out to the floor with a due pass recommendation of the bill as amended. Now we'll get on to the public hearing on House Bill 2096. And I have two people signed up on this bill.
Director of the department.
Okay, how do you say his name?
Crager.
Rick Crager.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps we'll have Mr. Crager first and anybody you wish to bring with you. Colleagues, this bill was heard first by the Consumer Protection Committee and then referred to us for consideration of the revenue issues. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Rick Crager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services, and with me today is Lynn Schessler. He's our Housing Finance Manager. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2096. This is a governor's bill filed through Oregon Housing Community Services, essentially working towards the preservation of manufactured parks. A little bit of background, there are approximately 1,300 manufactured dwelling parks in Oregon, comprising a very important segment of affordable housing in Oregon. In the past few years, as many of you know, we've seen a great deal of those lost. As land values begin to increase, there's a continued threat of the remaining parks out there. So the department is essentially proposing House Bill 2096 as one of the solutions to help preserve these parks, because we see this as a much cheaper way of preserving affordable housing as opposed to developing brand new housing. The primary purpose of House Bill 2096 is to enable existing resources to be used more effectively for park preservation. The department is recommending revisions to existing housing finance statute. And let me just kind of summarize for you. There are four essential parts to this bill. The first is a housekeeping and updating of existing statutes. There are several sections moved to different statute location for better organization of statutes, update of definition to elderly to match fair housing law, clarification of low, very low, and lower income, and finally clarification of terms defined as charges and fees within the statute. So the first piece, again, is just a housekeeping element. The second is a very important piece, is creating a new co-op in an entity called Manufactured Dwelling Park Nonprofit Co-op. And this is essentially modeled after what has happened in the state of New Hampshire, and it provides tenant-owned parks and has been very successful. Again, this bill is replicating something that has always been a great success in another state. The third part of this is allowing the department to assist parks with a significant percentage of low-income residents rather than requiring all residents to meet an income threshold. In addition, it's allowing the department to make a gap financing loans. And again, in referring to New Hampshire, one of the big areas that the state participated in was providing that necessary gap finance, and you get a lot of lenders that are willing to come up and do the 80% loan to value, but there has to be that gap financing that is instrumental in doing these. So this would allow the department be able to do that. And then lastly, One of our existing tools, the loan guarantee program, currently provides loan guarantees for 25% of the principal of primary loans or other loans out there, and this would actually move us up to 50%. And again, this would be an incentive to get the private industry to provide the gap financing that's necessary, or in some cases the primary financing that's existing. So those are, Mr. Chairman, essentially the four parts of the bill. I should just note that there is no fiscal impact associated with this bill. Again, it's enabling the department to use existing resources more effectively. And certainly, Lynn or myself would be open to any questions you might have.
Colleagues, the point of sending this bill here, I think, has to do with the fiscal issues involved with the loan guarantee program. I'm assuming that that's why it came here. So I think that it's important for us to understand how that loan guarantee program works and what effect this bill will have on that program. So perhaps you could deal with that question first, and then we'll take other questions from the committee.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think I'll ask Mr. Schessler, who administers the loan guarantee program, to provide you a little bit of information on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Schessler. I'm the Housing Finance Section Manager for Oregon Housing and Community Services. Currently, we have a 25% loan guarantee, and what that means is that a lender who's a bit uncomfortable with the deal but still wants to follow through on it might use the loan guarantee to assure them that should something go wrong with this loan, they have an opportunity to call upon the department's guarantee to make up any shortcomings that the borrower may not be able to perform. In the case of the manufactured dwelling park, as Rick indicated, traditionally lenders loan 80% loan to value, and the developer of an apartment project, for instance, would, through his own resources or investors, come up with that 20% second financing for the property. In the case of a manufactured dwelling park, that 20% gap is usually looked to the residents to be able to provide that, and frankly, in most mobile home parks where the residents are lower income, they do not have that resource. What we're trying to accomplish here is provide an incentive for a lender to loan that additional 20% and guarantee up to 50% of that loan to assure them, again, that should there be a loss, they could call upon the department's guarantee to fill that gap and make the property affordable.
Thank you. That deals with a piece of my question, and I think it would be useful, certainly for me and maybe for other members of the committee, if you gave us just a quick overview of the program that you currently have on loan guarantee, how you would find the gap financing loans, where that money would come from, and what the risk factors are that are different for this project, these kinds of projects, as compared, if they are different, as compared with what you currently do now. I think that the issues having to do with the manufactured dwelling park cooperatives and so forth have been dealt with by the Consumer Affairs Committee, but we're the fiscal watchdog, and so our job is to look at that issue. And so if you could give us a bit of a thumbnail about how that system works now, where these funds come from, and what you perceive the differences are in the system that this bill brings to the risks that you face as you deal with things, and what happens when there is a loss? Who pays? Where does the money come from? That kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the pool of funds that are used to call claims against the guarantee is essentially the corpus of the Housing Trust Fund. And that's been in place since 1991. We've had the loan guarantee program in place since 1991, and we've never had a claim, because what we do is we exercise some prudent underwriting. In the case of parks,
that's what I wanted to hear. Go ahead.
In the case of parks, we have even an additional assurance in that we're only financing land. On our conventional properties, where it's land and improvements where we exercise the guarantee, and there's some difference about performance and whether the collateral is there, should there we have to call and foreclose on our guarantee. In the case of the park, we're basically financing the land only. The first position is going to be for 80% of the value. We're going to be in second position, or guaranteeing the second position. And again, we're not going to exceed the value of the land. So the entire loan is 100% collateralized. We don't foresee any losses. And again, it's just an incentive for an uncomfortable lender to participate with the residents.
Thank you. Other questions?
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lynn, I continue to be concerned about the high cost of land under these 1,300 parks statewide, and the fact that we've got various programs that have been implemented over the past number of legislative sessions to try and get ahead of this. Are the programs that we've got working? Are we actually helping with these parks? And with the increase in the value in these lands, do we anticipate that this will be effective in getting ahead of this for these very low and very low income folks to be able to really assist them? Or are we always coming up a day late and a dollar short?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I hope we're not a day late and a dollar short. Certainly the real estate speculation that was going on last summer was very scary. We have several tales of owners purchasers from out of state doing options on parks they'd never seen because they knew they were in a location and someday they were going to be valuable and they wanted the opportunity to purchase them. Some of you have seen in your own districts parks that have come up for sale and the equivalent space price has been $100,000 per space. That's what the owner could get if they converted that land to a different use. Candidly, I don't think any of the programs we have out here are going to be able to help residents purchase a park where the space equivalent is $100,000 per space. It's just not going to work. But the analysis that we have done is that if the park price is anywhere in the $35,000 to $45,000 or maybe even $50,000 per space, with these tools and hopefully some other legislation that you will see, I think we can get there for those residents and help them purchase their park. It doesn't matter what happens. The residents are going to pay more. It's just a simple fact that the owner's going to sell. It's going to be worth. He's going to receive more money than he's presently realizing by way of the income from the rents. But it's still feasible for the residents to purchase their park if the space is in those ranges that I indicated.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler.
Well, I see two opposing forces coming at each other at a very rapid pace. We're redefining low and very low income, trying to help some folks down here at the bottom end. And then I see, and you talked about the speculation last summer. Well, I didn't know that it stopped last summer. I'm glad to know that somewhere it may have done. But unfortunately, real estate prices have continued to go up. And may have normalized in some places, but they've become still abnormally high. My concern is, do you really foresee that this will help as we redefine the low and very low income and how we want to reach in and help those people with the curved upwards trends of the real estate values? Are we going to be able to get in front of it to where we can really help some of these people? I mean, can you think of the 1,300 parks statewide today? Can you think of a half a dozen of them that are making application or that made inquiries to the department where we can really make a difference for some low and very low income folks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we can identify six. Are we successful? And my answer is yes. We are working with at least six parks around the state. The most predominant one is a large park down in Grants Pass, and we're actively working with the owner of that. And let me try not to create any disillusion here. This program will be most successful when we have a park owner who is willing to work with the residents to purchase it. If he's going for the highest bid, we may not be successful. But many of the park owners do have a sympathy for the residents. The residents have been very good to the park owners through the course of the years, and they're anxious to do what they can so long as they realize a fair value for their property in working with the residents, and this creates a tool that helps them out very much.
Excellent. And, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that this bill will make the difference in some of those six parks that you're dealing with.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Other questions of this panel? We have another witness to hear from. Gentlemen, don't go far. We may have questions as the hearing develops. Thank you very much. Mr. Peter Ferris.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Barnhart in the Revenue Committee. My name is Peter Ferris, and I've got to put my reading glasses on here because otherwise I can't see, even though I made it 14-point. But in any case, I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Manufactured Home Owners United, and we support HB 2096, and it's the first step in creating a win-win scenario for park owners, residents, municipalities, and taxpayers. It is modeled after a very successful loan program in New Hampshire, where more than 80 parks have been converted or created from the ground up as resident co-ops. Here in Oregon, however, we have a no-win-win strategies in place. We maintain that the current state statutes regarding landlord-tenant relationships in mobile manufactured home parks are fundamentally flawed. For more than 30 years, these statutes have governed this relationship as if it were the same as a tenant renting an apartment or house. This does not reflect the reality on the ground, as park residents have purchased homes that, along with the park owner's investment in land and facilities, have created communities that ensure both affordable housing and successful businesses. Since the 1950s, this co-investment has created a beneficial symbiotic relationship between park owners and residents across this nation. That is, until the recent spike in closures here in Oregon over the past 5 years, where over 60 parks with approximately 2,300 spaces have closed. Recently, two legislative proposals, HB 2600 and the coalition bill, which I guess what I think it just came out, was just printed today, and does anyone have the number on that? 2735. These two legislative proposals represent the continuation of a we win, you lose mentality that is flat out bad public policy. It represents the status quo and more of the same, subsidizing owner profits while causing misery to some of the most vulnerable in our society and creating significant economic, social, environmental, psychological, and healthcare costs that deplete already scarce federal, state, and local resources. We can do better. Our vision is one of a future that creates a more level playing field between park owners and residents, that creates incentives for the sale of parks to residents when possible, that encourages banks and loan funds to no longer discriminate when it comes to loans to park homeowners, and recognizes that such parks represent the most efficient way to create and maintain affordable housing in Oregon. At present, HB 2096 is a good idea in search of implementation. It is now only a shell, offering hope but no promises to secure low-interest secondary loans, the key to resident park purchases. The Department of Housing for Community Services asked for $18 million in the 2007-08 budget for making available these loans and hiring staff for necessary technical assistance in incorporating the co-ops and putting together purchase proposals, yet the governor eliminated this funding in his budget. We need a comprehensive, coordinated approach to raising this seed money. And I might add here that in New Hampshire, more than 20 years ago, when the seed money was created by money loaned to them by the Ford Foundation, we support SB 38, championed by the Housing Alliance, that would generate $30 million for affordable housing statewide each year. But we need more, especially at a time when baby boomers are retiring and new construction of affordable housing has been minimal. In addition, the existing bill needs to be amended to make it feasible so that both co-ops and resident associations can compete with other buyers of parks. We need a level playing field. The continuation of existing waiver of capital gains tax in HB 2600 when owners sell to residents is a step in the right direction. Yet the bill doesn't change current statute that would provide more than 2 weeks for residential associations to put a purchase proposal together after being notified by the park owner. Now, I've noticed that the new coalition bill changes this to 60 days. We would recommend 90, but that's just come out today, and I just noticed that. This is entirely too short a time. 90 days would be more appropriate. We would also ask you to amend line 7 on page 7 of HB 2096 to include persons who are elderly, along with those who are of lower income. We'd like to see all parks preserved if possible. Finally, we would remind you that money loaned in such a program is money well spent. Because such loans are paid back and therefore can be recycled to assist in purchasing other parks, they are examples of one of the best uses of state funds possible. And I guess in summary, I would say to you that this will not work all the time, definitely. We know in the case of, for example, Thunderbird Club in Wilsonville, it hasn't worked, where you have 62 acres of land right next to I-5 assessed at anywhere, well, from $35 to $50 million. So it won't work for them. But what's happening now in New Hampshire is very interesting, is that the last 4 or 5 years, they're creating actual new parks from the ground up. And this may interest you in some of Representative Butler's comments about what are we going to do with these people when they're thrown out on the streets. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ferris. We appreciate your testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Ferris? Representative Butler.
I think Mr. Ferris brought up an excellent point of including the elderly amongst those folks that should be considered in this process, and I'm not sure that they're not, but I think that's appropriate. I also am very concerned about a 60-day timeline. You don't put together a home purchase in much less than 60 days anymore with all of the financing issues. These are multi-million dollar facilities at best. And I don't know your experience in working with the various state agencies, and my hope is that Housing Community Services is lightning speed compared to some of the others. But even at lightning speed in government, probably 90 days isn't enough. So I would certainly look favorably.
I can tell you that in New Hampshire, where they have been doing this for over 20 years and have got a system down, and it's run by a nonprofit, but they are very efficient, but they can't do it they prefer at least 60 days, 60 to 90 days.
Mm-hmm. Is that in this bill that's in a different... In a different bill,
there is it regards a statute that I've cited the two statutes there, but the coalition bill has suggested that we needed to extend that to 60 days. I think it needs to go to 90. But
okay, now all right, but that's coming up in a different bill.
That's correct.
Did you raise these issues with the other committee?
I did raise those issues, but wasn't able to attend that day, and I raised them, and I sent them emails to that effect, and so and I listened to them, you know, because I live on the coast. I listened to them, but they didn't address those at that time. No.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Well, I was just going to comment on the adding of elderly residents. I would be a little cautious in that, because I think the target here is the lower income, not just the elderly. And having been to Arizona and seen mobile parks that were absolutely filled with elderly residents who have no income problems whatsoever, mm-hmm. I'd be careful that we make that a criteria.
I would just to give you an example. We have a situation in North Eugene in which a hospital is being sited at the end of a road, and there is I would call manufactured home park. It's not most of the parks that are being closed are parks that are 30 or 40 years old and that have been mined, and you know, improvements need to be made, and the owner decides, well, maybe I ought to just sell, and he finds that somebody out there is willing to buy it. But that park could, because of the the land values there because of the siting of the hospital. If the hospital indeed does site there, there would be a big problem. And, you know, those people, yeah, they've bought houses in the $150,000 to $200,000 category, but their rent is affordable. And I think, you know, it's triage, you know, basically. And I think that at this point, OHCS is concerned first with the people who have the lower income people, but there's usually a mix. In my park, there's a mix, so you can never tell. And so I would say to you that let's don't leave the manufactured home parks out of the loop. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share Representative Butler's concerns, and I think that Mr. Ferris's recommendations of 90 days probably better reflect reality.
Thank you. Lynn, would you address these two questions that we were talking about? One is the elderly versus low income, and the other one is this period of time for an offer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the 90-day suggestion is not a provision that's contained in House Bill 2096. That's in the coalition's bill.
So that's a separate issue?
That's a separate issue entirely, and I would expect that during the course of hearings on that bill, this issue will be raised and the opportunity will present itself there to make that amendment if the committee
and
so
And, of course,
desires.
That's not really within the purview of this committee anyway. The other one might be, and perhaps you could talk about that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, certainly identifying lower income does not exclude the elderly in any fashion. And in fact, within our statutes, we have the specific authority under the elderly and disabled general obligation bonds to finance parks if indeed the park is 100% occupied by elderly. So we have the provision to do that. The other thing I would point out is that, indeed, I would agree with Mr. Ferris and your observations that there are parks where some residents do have an income above what we would consider lower income, and that's why we in our statute specifically identified it, we would participate and work with parks where there was a significant percentage of residents who are lower income. The circumstance we don't want to get into is compelling a park to be entirely low income, right, and then one of those residents through inheritance receives $100,000, $200,000, whatever it might be, and that puts them above the definition of low income. They live in that park, but additionally they own the unit that's in that park, and for that co-op or our financing to preclude them from living there and have to dispose of their house because now they exceed income, I just don't think that would be a fair circumstance. So that's why we've said we want the predominance of the benefit provided by the authority in this bill to help the residents of a park, and we want the predominance of those beneficiaries to be lower income, but not exclusively lower income.
Thank you. Does that deal with your question, Representative Berger?
I have another question.
Yes, please, go ahead.
While he's in the chair. Under the provisions of this bill, and as experienced in New Hampshire that you've modeled in it, then the question has to be asked, are new parks possible, a new park to be started as a co-op, specifically targeted at a, sort of a low-income housing piece, or is this bill primarily or written to be only applicable to existing parks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, certainly a new park is feasible. It's dependent upon land value in a given area, and it also is highly dependent upon the grade of infrastructure that has to be installed to make those units serviced by water, sewer, and the other utilities. What we're hearing from development community is that it's the land value and utilities that make parks infeasible. Certainly, as parks were developed historically, there were lesser standards related to the utilities within the boundaries of the park, and that's some of the benefit of older parks, less expensive land, lesser utility expenses.
Thank you.
May I just mention one other
yes,
thing
please,
about that?
Yes, please, Mr. Ferris.
When there were three large parks in Bend that recently closed, and the city of Bend was considering using some park land that they had purchased, not all of it, but a portion of it, to create a new park. So, and they bought this years ago when it was you know, modest. It was cheaper than it would be today in Bend, and they were considering that. They chose not to do that, but it seems to me that that's an option that maybe municipalities, and you know, here the concern is municipalities in four cities have come forward and actually enhanced the state law, and because they're trying to protect their citizens. That's Wilsonville, Oregon City, Bend, and Eugene. So I think that they're, you know, you want to give them some wiggle room to be able to provide that sort of thing.
Thank you. Further questions? Maybe I have one that that relates to the issue we were just talking about, and I'm not certain now, so I get back to the part of the bill that refers to that. There are several sections in here that talk about successor owners, and I'll see if I can find it again. It's the new language on page 2 and 3. I guess it talks about the cooperative dissolving, so I guess it doesn't deal with the issue I was thinking it might deal with. It occurs to me, and maybe I can ask the question this way, that there are existing agencies that regularly deal with low-income housing that might find this medium a useful tool under some circumstances. Do you think this bill can, this bill, assuming it's adopted, can be adapted to the utilization by those kinds of small agencies? Usually we're talking about small nonprofits that may end up owning the property themselves or may end up spinning off another nonprofit corporation to own the property. What's your sense of that?
Mr. Chair, as this bill was crafted, both the agency as well as the drafters of the particular cooperative piece of this bill closely corresponded with the community development corporations, the housing authorities, the other nonprofits around the state to make sure that this benefited them as well. And I think there's general agreement on all parties that this bill does and can be used for other purposes as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Further questions? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on House Bill 2096? Seeing and hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2096. Is there any further business to come before the committee today? I think our agenda is exhausted. Thank you, Representative Bruin.
We
appreciate your attendance, and we are adjourned.